The Forever War, Disc 7.
The room the tanks were in resembled a huge chemical factory. The floor was a good 100 meters in diameter, and jammed with bulky apparatus painted a uniform dull gray. The 8 tanks were arranged almost symmetrically around the central elevator. The symmetry spoiled by the fact that one of the tanks was twice the size of the others. That would be the command tank, for all the senior officers and supporting specialists. Sergeant Blazinski stepped out from behind one of the tanks and saluted. I didn't return his salute. What the hell is that? In all that universe of gray, there was one spot of color. It's a cat, sir. Do tell. A big one, too, and bright calico. It looked ridiculous, draped over the sergeant's shoulder. Let me rephrase the question. What the hell is a cat doing here? It's the maintenance squad's mascot, sir. The cat raised its head enough to hiss half-heartedly at me, then returned to its flaccid repose. I looked at Charlie, and he shrugged back. It seems kind of cruel, he said. To the sergeant, you won't get much use of it. After 25 G's, it'll be just so much fur and guts. Oh, no, sir. Sirs. He roughed back the fur between the creature's shoulders. It had a fluorocarbon fitting embedded there, just like the one above my hip bone. We bought it at a store on Stargate, already modified. Lots of ships have them now, sir. The Commodore signed the forms for us. Well, that was her right. Maintenance was under both of us equally, and it was her ship. You couldn't have gotten a dog? God, I hated cats. Always sneaking around. No, sir, they don't adapt. Can't take free fall. Did you have to make any special adaptations in the tank? Charlie asked. No, sir, we had an extra couch. Great. That meant I'd be sharing a tank with the animal. We only had to shorten the straps. It takes a different kind of drug for the cell wall strengthening, but that was included in the price. Charlie scratched it behind an ear. It purred softly, but didn't move. Seems kind of stupid. The animal, I mean. We drugged him ahead of time. No wonder it was so inert. The drug slows your metabolism down to a rate barely adequate to sustain life. Makes it easier to strap him in. Guess it's all right, I said. Maybe good for morale. But if it starts getting in the way, I'll personally recycle it. Yes, sir, he said, visibly relieved, thinking that I couldn't really do anything like that to such a cute bundle of fur. Try me, buddy. So we had seen it all. The only thing left, this side of the engines, was the huge hold where the fighters and drones waited, clamped in their massive cradles against the coming acceleration. Charlie and I went down to take a look, but there were no windows on our side of the airlock. I knew there'd be one on the inside, but the chamber was evacuated, and it wasn't worth going through the fill and warm cycle merely to satisfy our curiosity. I was starting to feel really supernumerary. Called Hillebo, and she said everything was under control. With an hour to kill, we went back to the lounge and had the computer mediate a game of Kriegspieler, which was just starting to get interesting, when the 10-minute warning sounded. The acceleration tanks had a half-life to failure of 5 weeks. There was a 50-50 chance that you could stay immersed for 5 weeks before some valve or tube popped and you were squashed like a bug underfoot. In practice, it had to be one hell of an emergency to justify using the tanks for more than 2 weeks' acceleration. We were only going under for 10 days, this first leg of our journey. 5 weeks or 5 hours, though, it was all the same as far as the tankee was concerned. Once the pressure got up to an operational level, You had no sense of the passage of time. Your body and brain were concrete. None of your senses provided any input, and you could amuse yourself for several hours just trying to spell your own name. So I wasn't really surprised that no time seemed to have passed when I was suddenly dry, my body tingling with the return of sensation. The place sounded like an asthmatics convention in the middle of a hayfield. 39 people and one cat, all coughing and sneezing to get rid of the last residues of fluorocarbon. While I was fumbling with my straps, the side door opened, flooding the tank with painfully bright light. The cat was the first one out, with a general scramble right behind him. For the sake of dignity, I waited until last. Over 100 people were milling around outside, stretching and massaging out cramps. Dignity. Surrounded by acres of young female flesh, I stared into their faces and desperately tried to solve a third-order differential equation in my head to circumvent the gallant reflex. A temporary expedient, but it got me to the elevator. Hillebo was shouting orders, getting people lined up, and as the doors closed, I noticed that all of one platoon had a uniform light bruise from head to foot. 20 pairs of black eyes. I'd have to see both maintenance and medical about that. After I got dressed. Chapter 4. We stayed at 1G for 3 weeks, with occasional periods of free fall for navigation check, while the Masaryk II made a long, narrow loop away from the Collapsar Resh 10 and back again. That period went all right, the people adjusting pretty well to ship routine. I gave them a minimum of busy work and a maximum of training review and exercise, for their own good, though I wasn't naive enough to think they'd see it that way. After about a week of 1G, Private Rudkowski, the cook's assistant, had a still producing some 8 liters a day of 95% ethyl alcohol. I didn't want to stop him. Life was cheerless enough. I didn't mind as long as people showed up for duty sober. But I was damn curious both how he managed to divert the raw materials out of our sealed-tied ecology and how the people paid for their booze. So I used the chain of command in reverse, asking Alcivor to find out. She asked Jarvel, who asked Carreras, who sat down with Orban, the cook. Turned out that Sergeant Orban had set the whole thing up, letting Rudkowski do the dirty work, and was aching to brag about it to a trustworthy person. If I had ever taken meals with the enlisted men and women, I might have figured out that something odd was going on, but the scheme didn't extend up to officers' country. Through Rudkowski, Orban had jury-rigged a ship-wide economy based on alcohol. It went like this. Each meal was prepared with one very sugary dessert, jelly, custard, or flan, which you were free to eat if you could stand the cloying taste. But if it was still on your tray when you presented it at the recycling window, Rudkowski would give you a 10-cent chit and scrape the sugary stuff into a fermentation vat. He had 2 20-liter vats, one working while the other was being filled. The 10-cent chit was at the bottom of a system that allowed you to buy a half-liter of straight ethyl, with your choice of flavoring, for $5. A squad of 5 people who skipped all of their desserts could buy about a liter a week, enough for a party, but not enough to constitute a public health problem. When Diana brought me this information, she also brought a bottle of Rudkowski's Worst. Literally. It was a flavor that just hadn't worked. It came up through the chain of command with only a few centimeters missing. Its taste was a ghastly combination of strawberry and caraway seed. With a perversity not uncommon to people who rarely drink, Diana loved it. I had some ice water brought up, and she got totally blasted within an hour. For myself, I made one drink and didn't finish it. When she was more than halfway to oblivion, mumbling a reassuring soliloquy to her liver, she suddenly tilted her head up to stare at me with childlike directness. "You have a real problem, Major William."
"Not half the problem you'll have in the morning, Lieutenant Doctor Diana."
"Oh, not really."
She waved a drunken hand in front of her face.
"Some vitamins, some glucose, an easy cc of adrenaline, if all else fails. You have a real problem."
"Look, Diana, don't you want me to..."
"What you need is to get an appointment with that nice Corporal Valdez."
Valdez was the male sex counselor.
"He has empathy. It's his job. He'd make you..."
"We talked about this before, remember? I want to stay the way I am."
"Don't we all?"
She wiped away a tear that was probably 1% alcohol.
"You know they call you the old Crear?"
"No, they don't." She looked at the floor and then at the wall.
"The old Queer, that's what."
I had expected names worse than that, but not so soon.
"I don't care. The commander always gets names." "I know, but..."
She stood up suddenly and wobbled a little bit.
"Too much to drink. Lie down."
She turned her back to me and stretched so hard that a joint popped. Then a seam whispered open, and she shrugged off her tunic, stepped out of it, and tiptoed to my bed. She sat down and patted the mattress.
"Come on, William. Only chance."
"For Christ's sake, Diana, it wouldn't be fair."
"All's fair," she giggled. "And sides, I'm a doctor. I can be clinical. Won't bother me a bit. Help me with this."
After 500 years, they were still putting brassiere clasps in the back. One kind of gentleman would have helped her get undressed and then made a quiet exit. Another kind of gentleman might have bolted for the door. Being neither kind, I closed in for the kill. Perhaps, fortunately, she passed out before we had made any headway. I admired the sight and touch of her for a long time before, feeling like a cad. I managed to gather everything up and dress her. I lifted her out of the bed, sweet burden, and then realized that if anyone saw me carrying her down to her billet, she'd be the butt of rumors for the rest of the campaign. I called up Charlie, told him we'd had some booze, and Diana was rather the worse for it, and asked him whether he'd come up for a drink and help me haul the good doctor home. By the time Charlie knocked, she was draped innocently in a chair, snoring softly. He smiled at her.
"Physician, heal thyself."
I offered him the bottle with a warning. He sniffed it and made a face.
"What is this, varnish?"
"Just something the cooks whipped up, vacuum still." He set it down carefully as if it might explode if jarred.
"I predict a shortage of customers. Epidemic of death by poisoning." "She actually drank that vile stuff?"
"Well, the cooks admitted it was an experiment that didn't pan out. Their other flavors are evidently potable." "Yeah, she loved it."
"Well," he laughed. "Damn. What, you take her leg and I take her arms?"
"No, look, we each take an arm. Maybe we can get her to do part of the walking." She moaned a little when we lifted her out of the chair, opened one eye, and said,
"Hello, Charlie."
Then she closed the eye and let us drag her down to the billet. No one saw us on the way, but her bunkmate, Lassonen, was sitting up reading.
"She really drank the stuff, eh?"
She regarded her friend with wry affection.
"Here, let me help."
The three of us wrestled her into bed. Lassonen smoothed the hair out of her eyes.
"She said it was in the nature of an experiment."
more devotion to science than I have, Charlie said. A stronger stomach, too. We all wished he hadn't said that. Diana sheepishly admitted that she hadn't remembered anything after the first drink, and talking to her, I deduced that she thought Charlie had been there all along, which was all for the best, of course. But oh, Diana, my lovely latent heterosexual, let me buy you a bottle of good scotch the next time we come into port, 700 years from now. We got back into the tanks with a hop from Raish 10 to Cough 35. That was 2 weeks at 25 Gs. Then we had another 4 weeks of routine at one gravity. I had announced my open-door policy, but practically no one ever took advantage of it. I saw very little of the troops, and those occasions were almost always negative, testing them on their training review, handing out reprimands, and occasionally lecturing classes. And they rarely spoke intelligibly, except in response to a direct question. Most of them either had English as their native tongue or as a second language, but it had changed so drastically over 450 years that I could barely understand it. Not at all, if it was spoken rapidly. Fortunately, they had all been taught early 21st century English during their basic training. That language, or dialect, served as a temporal lingua franca, through which a 25th century soldier could communicate with someone who had been a contemporary of his 19 times great-grandparents, if there had still been such a thing as grandparents. I thought of my first combat commander, Captain Stott, whom I had hated just as cordially as the rest of the company did, and tried to imagine how I would have felt if he had been a sexual deviant, and I'd been forced to learn a new language for his convenience. So we had discipline problems, sure. But the wonder was that we had any discipline at all. Hillebo was responsible for that. As little as I liked her personally, I had to give her credit for keeping the troops in line. Most of the shipboard graffiti concerned improbable sexual geometries between the second field officer and her commander. From Cough 35, we jumped to Samek 78. From there, to IN 129, and finally, to Sada 138. Most of the jumps were no more than a few hundred light years, but the last one was 140,000. Supposedly the longest collapsar jump ever made by a manned craft. The time spent scooting down the wormhole from one collapsar to the next was always the same, independent of the distance. When I'd studied physics, they thought the duration of a collapsar jump was exactly zero. But a couple of centuries later, they did a complicated waveguide experiment that proved the jump actually lasted some small fraction of a nanosecond. Doesn't seem like much, but they'd had to rebuild physics from the foundation up when the collapsar jump was first discovered. They had to tear the whole damn thing down again when they found out it took time to get from A to B. Physicists were still arguing about it. But we had more pressing problems as we flashed out of Sada 138's collapsar field at three-quarters of the speed of light. There was no way to tell immediately whether the Torrens had beat us there. We launched a pre-programmed drone that would decelerate at 300 Gs and take a preliminary look around. It would warn us if it detected any other ships in the system or evidence of Torren activity on any of the collapsar's planets. The drone launched, we zipped up in the tanks, and the computers put us through a 3-week evasive maneuver while the ship slowed down. No problems, except that 3 weeks is a hell of a long time to stay frozen in the tank. For a couple of days afterward, everybody crept around like aged cripples. If the drone had sent back word that the Torrens were already in the system, we would immediately have stepped down to 1G and started deploying fighters and drones armed with Nova bombs. Or we might not have lived that long. Sometimes the Torrens could get to a ship only hours after it entered the system. Dying in the tank might not be the most pleasant way to go. It took us a month to get back to within a couple of AUs of Sada 138, where the drone had found a planet that met our requirements. It was an odd planet, slightly smaller than Earth, but more dense. It wasn't quite the cryogenic deep freeze that most portal planets were, both because of heat from its core and because S. Doradus, the brightest star in the cloud, was only a third of a light year away. The strangest feature of the planet was its lack of geography. From space, it looked like a slightly damaged billiard ball. Our resident physicist, Lieutenant Gim, explained its relatively pristine condition by pointing out that its anomalous, almost cometary orbit probably meant that it had spent most of its life as a rogue planet, drifting alone through interstellar space. The chances were good that it had never been struck by a large meteor until it wandered into Sada 138's bailiwick and was captured, forced to share space with all the other flotsam the Collapsar dragged around with it. We left the Masaryk II in orbit. It was capable of landing, but that would restrict its visibility and getaway time, and shuttled building materials down to the surface with the six fighters. It was good to get out of the ship, even though the planet wasn't exactly hospitable. The atmosphere was a thin, cold wind of hydrogen and helium, it being too cold, even at noon, for any other substance to exist as a gas. Noon was when S. Doradus was overhead, a tiny, painfully bright spark. The temperature slowly dropped at night, going from 25 degrees Kelvin down to 17 degrees, which caused problems, because just before dawn, the hydrogen would start to condense out of the air, making everything so slippery that it was useless to do anything other than sit down and wait it out. At dawn, a faint pastel rainbow provided the only relief from the black and white monotony of the landscape. The ground was treacherous, covered with little granular chunks of frozen gas that shifted slowly, incessantly, in the anemic breeze. You had to walk in a slow waddle to stay on your feet. Of the four people who would die during the base's construction, three would be the victims of simple falls. The troops weren't happy with my decision to construct the anti-spacecraft and perimeter defenses before putting up living quarters. That was by the book, though, and they got 2 days of shipboard rest for every day planetside, which wasn't overly generous, I admit, since ship days were 24 hours long, and a day on the planet was 38.5 hours, from dawn to dawn. The base was completed in just less than 4 weeks, and it was a formidable structure indeed. The perimeter, a circle 1 kilometer in diameter, was guarded by 25 gigawatt lasers that would automatically aim and fire within 1/1000th of a second. They would react to the motion of any significantly large object between the perimeter and the horizon. Sometimes, when the wind was right and the ground damp with hydrogen, the little ice granules would stick together into a loose snowball and begin to roll. They wouldn't roll far. For early protection, before the enemy came over our horizon, the base was in the center of a huge minefield. The buried mines would detonate upon sufficient distortion of their local gravitational fields. A single Torren would set one off if he came within 20 meters of it. A small spacecraft, 1 kilometer overhead, would also detonate it. There were 2,800 of them, mostly 100-microton nuclear bombs. 50 of them were devastatingly powerful tachyon devices. They were all scattered at random in a ring that extended from the limit of the laser's effectiveness out another 5 kilometers. Inside the base, we relied on individual lasers, microton grenades, and a tachyon-powered repeating rocket launcher that had never been tried in combat. one per platoon. As a last resort, the stasis field was set up beside the living quarters. Inside its opaque gray dome, as well as enough Paleolithic weaponry to hold off the Golden Horde, we'd stashed a small cruiser, just in case we managed to lose all our spacecraft in the process of winning a battle. 12 people would be able to get back to Stargate. It didn't do to dwell on the fact that the other survivors would have to sit on their hands until relieved by reinforcements, or death. The living quarters and administration facilities were all underground to protect them from line-of-sight weapons. It didn't do too much for morale, though. There were waiting lists for every outside detail, no matter how strenuous or risky. I hadn't wanted the troops to go up to the surface in their free time, both because of the danger involved and the administrative headache of constantly checking equipment in and out and keeping track of who was where. Finally, I had to relent and allow people to go up for a few hours every week. There was nothing to see except the featureless plane and the sky, which was dominated by S. Doradus during the day, and the huge dim oval of the galaxy at night. But that was an improvement over staring at the melted rock walls and ceiling. A favorite sport was to walk out to the perimeter and throw snowballs in front of the laser. See how small a snowball you could throw and still set the weapon off. It seemed to me that the entertainment value of this pastime was about equal to watching a faucet drip. But there was no real harm in it, since the weapons would only fire outward, and we had power to spare. For 5 months, things went pretty smoothly. Such administrative problems as we had were similar to those we'd encountered on the Masaryk II, and we were in less danger as passive troglodytes than we had been scooting from collapsar to collapsar, at least until the enemy showed up. I looked the other way when Rudkoski reassembled his still. Anything that broke the monotony of garrison duty was welcome. And the chits not only provided booze for the troops, but gave them something to gamble with. I only interfered in two ways. Nobody could go outside unless they were totally sober, and nobody could sell sexual favors. Maybe that was the Puritan in me, but it was, again, by the book. The opinion of the supporting specialists was split. Lieutenant Wilbur, the psychiatric officer, agreed with me. The sex counselors, Cogdi and Valdez, didn't. But then they were probably coining money, being the resident professionals. 5 months of comfortably boring routine. And then along came Private Graubard. For obvious reasons, no weapons were allowed in the living quarters. The way these people were trained, even a fist fight could be a duel to the death, and tempers were short. 100 merely normal people would probably have been at each other's throats after a week in our caves, but these soldiers had been hand-picked for their ability to get along in close confinement. Still, there were fights. Graubard had almost killed his ex-lover, Sean, when that worthy made a face at him in the chow line. He had a week of solitary detention. So did Sean, for having precipitated it. And then psychiatric counseling and punitive details. Then I transferred him to the 4th platoon, so he wouldn't be seeing Sean every day. The first time they passed in the halls, Graubard greeted Sean with a karate kick to the throat. Diana had to build him a new trachea. Graubard got a more intensive round of detention, counseling, and details. Hell, I couldn't transfer him to another company. And then he was a good boy for 2 weeks. I fiddled their work and chow schedules so the two would never be in the same room together. But they met in a corridor again. And this time, it came out more even. Sean got 2 broken ribs, but Graubard got a ruptured testicle and lost 4 teeth. If it kept up, I was going to have at least 1 less mouth to feed. By the Universal Code of Military Justice, I could have ordered Graubard executed, since we were technically in a state of combat. Perhaps I should have, then and there. But Charlie suggested a more humanitarian solution, and I accepted it. We didn't have enough room to keep Graubard in solitary detention forever, which seemed to be the only humane yet practical thing to do. But they had plenty of room aboard the Masaryk, too, hovering overhead in a stationary orbit. I called Antipol, and she agreed to take care of him. I gave her permission to space the bastard if he gave her any trouble. We called a general assembly to explain things, so that the lesson of Graubard wouldn't be lost on anybody. I was just starting to talk, standing on the rock dais with the company sitting in front of me, and the officers and Graubard behind me, when the crazy fool decided to kill me. Like everybody else, Graubard was assigned 5 hours per week of training inside the stasis field. Under close supervision, the soldiers would practice using their swords and spears and whatnot on dummy Torrens. Somehow, Graubard had managed to smuggle out a weapon, an Indian chakra, which is a circle of metal with a razor-keen outer edge. It's a tricky weapon, but once you know how to use it, it can be much more effective than a regular throwing knife. Graubard was an expert. All in a fraction of a second, Graubard disabled the people on either side of him, hitting Charlie in the temple with an elbow, while he broke Hillebo's kneecap with a kick and slid the chakra out of his tunic and spun it toward me in one smooth action. It had covered half the distance to my throat before I reacted. Instinctively, I slapped out to deflect it, and came within a centimeter of losing 4 fingers. The razor edge slashed open the top of my palm, but I succeeded in knocking the thing off course. And Graubard was rushing me, teeth bared, in an expression I hope I never see again. Maybe he didn't realize that the old queer was really only 5 years older than he. That the old queer had combat reflexes and 3 weeks of negative feedback kinesthesia training. At any rate, it was so easy I almost felt sorry for him. His right toe was turning in. I knew he would take one more step and go into a savat leap. I adjusted the distance between us with a short balestra, and just as both his feet left the ground, gave him an ungentle side kick to the solar plexus. He was unconscious before he hit the ground, but not dead. If I'd merely killed him in self-defense, my troubles would have been over, instead of suddenly being multiplied. A simple psychotic troublemaker a commander can lock up and forget about, but not a failed assassin, and I didn't have to take a poll to know that executing him was not going to improve my relationship with the troops. I realized that Diana was on her knees beside me, trying to pry open my fingers. "Check Hillebo and more," I mumbled. "And to the troops." "Dismissed." Chapter 5.
"Don't be an ass," Charlie said. He was holding a damp rag to the bruise on the side of his head.
"You don't think I have to execute him?"
"Stop twitching." Diana was trying to get the lips of my wound to line up together so she could paint them shut. From the wrist down, the hand felt like a lump of ice.
"Not by your own hand, you don't. You can detail someone at random."
"Charlie's right," Diana said. "Have everybody draw a slip of paper out of a bowl."
I was glad Hillebo was sound asleep on the other cot. I didn't need her opinion. "And if the person so chosen refuses?"
"Punish him and get another," Charlie said.
"Didn't you learn anything in the can? You can't abrogate your authority by publicly doing a job that obviously should be detailed."
"Any other job, sure, but for this, nobody in the company is ever killed. It would look like I was getting somebody else to do my moral dirty work."
If it's so damn complicated, Diana said, why not just get up in front of the troops and tell them how complicated it is? Then have them draw straws. They aren't children.
There had been an army in which that sort of thing was done, a strong quasi-memory told me. The Marxist Poom Militia in the Spanish Civil War, early 20th. You obeyed an order only after it had been explained in detail. You could refuse if it didn't make sense. Officers and men got drunk together and never saluted or used titles. They lost the war, but the other side didn't have any fun. Finished. Diana set the limp hand in my lap. Don't try to use it for a half hour. When it starts to hurt, you can use it. I inspected the wound closely. The lines don't match up. Not that I'm complaining.
You shouldn't. By all rights, you ought to have just a stump and no regeneration facilities this side of Stargate.
Stump ought to be at the top of your neck, Charlie said.
I don't see why you have any qualms. You should have killed the bastard outright.
I know that, goddammit! Both Charlie and Diana jumped at my outburst.
Sorry, shit. Look, just let me do the worrying. Why don't you both talk about something else for a while?
Diana got up and checked the contents of her medical bag.
I've got another patient to check. Try to keep from exciting each other.
Graubard? Charlie asked.
That's right, to make sure he can mount the scaffold without assistance.
What if Hillebo?
She'll be out for another half hour. I'll send Jarville down just in case.
She hurried out the door. The scaffold. I hadn't given that any thought. How the hell are we going to execute him? We can't do it indoors. Morale. Firing squad would be pretty grisly.
Chuck him out the airlock. You don't owe him any ceremony.
You're probably right. I wasn't thinking about him. I wondered whether Charlie had ever seen the body of a person who died that way. Maybe we ought to just stuff him into the recycler. He'd wind up there eventually. Charlie laughed.
That's the spirit.
We'd have to trim him up a little bit. Door's not very wide. Charlie had a few suggestions as how to get around that. Jarville came in and more or less ignored us. Suddenly, the infirmary door banged open. A patient on a cart, Diana rushing alongside, pressing on the man's chest, while a private pushed. Two other privates were following, but hung back at the door.
Over by the wall, she ordered.
It was Graubard.
Tried to kill himself, Diana said,
but that was pretty obvious.
Heart stopped.
He'd made a noose of his belt. It was still hanging limply around his neck. There were two big electrodes with rubber handles hanging on the wall. Diana snatched them with one hand while she ripped his tunic open with the other.
Get your hands off the cart!
She held the electrodes apart, kicked a switch, and pressed them down onto his chest. They made a low hum while his body trembled and flopped. Smell of burning flesh. Diana was shaking her head.
Get ready to crack him, she said to Jarville. Get Doris down here.
The body was gurgling, but it was a mechanical sound, like plumbing. She kicked off the power and let the electrodes drop, pulled a ring off her finger, and crossed to stick her arms in the sterilizer. Jarville started to rub an evil-smelling fluid over the man's chest. There was a small red mark between the two electrode burns. It took me a moment to realize what it was. Jarville wiped it away. I stepped closer and checked Graubard's neck.
Get out of the way, William. You aren't sterile.
Diana felt his collarbone, measured down a little ways, and made an incision straight down to the bottom of his breastbone. Blood welled out, and Jarville handed her an instrument that looked like big chrome-plated bolt cutters. I looked away, but couldn't help hearing the thing crunch through his ribs. She asked for retractors and sponges and so on while I wandered back to where I'd been sitting.
With the corner of my eye, I saw her working away, inside his thorax, massaging his heart directly. Charlie looked the way I felt. He called out weakly, "Hey, don't knock yourself out, Diana." She didn't answer. Jarvel had wheeled up the artificial heart and was holding out two tubes. Diana picked up a scalpel, and I looked away again. He was still dead a half hour later. They turned off the machine and threw a sheet over him. Diana washed the blood off her arms and said, "Got to change, back in a minute." I got up and walked to her billet next door. Had to know. I raised my hand to knock, but it was suddenly hurting like there was a line of fire drawn across it. I rapped with my left, and she opened the door immediately.
"What? Oh, you want something for your hand?"
She was half-dressed, unself-conscious.
"Ask Jarvel."
"No, that's not it. What happened, Diana?"
"Oh, well..."
She pulled a tunic over her head, and her voice was muffled.
"It was my fault, I guess. I left him alone for a minute."
"And he tried to hang himself?"
"That's right."
She sat on the bed and offered me the chair. "I went off to the head, and he was dead by the time I got back. I'd already sent Jarvel away because I didn't want Hillebo to be unsupervised for too long."
"But Diana, there's no mark on his neck. No bruise, nothing."
She shrugged.
"The hanging didn't kill him. He had a heart attack.
Somebody gave him a shot, right over his heart." She looked at me curiously.
"I did that, William. Adrenaline, standard procedure."
"You get that red dot of expressed blood if you jerk away from the projector while you're getting a shot. Otherwise, the medicine goes right through the pores, doesn't leave a mark."
"He was dead when you gave him the shot?" "That would be my professional opinion."
"Deadpan.
No heartbeat, pulse, respiration. Very few other disorders show these symptoms."
"Yeah, I see.
Is something... What's the matter, William?"
Either I'd been improbably lucky, or Diana was a very good actress.
"Nothing.
Yeah, I better get something for this hand." I opened the door. Saved me a lot of trouble. She looked straight into my eyes.
"That's true."
Actually, I traded one kind of trouble for another. Despite the fact that there were several disinterested witnesses to Graubard's demise, there was a persistent rumor that I'd had Doc Alsever simply exterminate him, since I'd botched the job myself and didn't want to go through a troublesome court-martial. The fact was that under the Universal Code of Military Justice, Graubard hadn't deserved any kind of trial at all. All I had to do was say, you, take this man out and kill him, please. And woe betide the private who refused to carry out the order. My relationship with the troops did improve, in a sense. At least, outwardly, they showed more deference to me. But I suspected it was at least partly the cheap kind of respect you might offer any ruffian who had proved himself to be dangerous and volatile. So, Killer was my new name. Just when I'd gotten used to Old Queer. The base quickly settled back into its routine of training and waiting. I was almost impatient for the Torrens to show up, just to get it over with one way or the other. The troops had adjusted to the situation much better than I had, for obvious reasons. They had specific duties to perform, and ample free time for the usual soldierly anodynes to boredom. My duties were more varied, but offered little satisfaction, since the problems that percolated up to me were of the buck-stops-here type. Those with pleasing, unambiguous solutions were taken care of in the lower echelons. I'd never cared much for sports or games, but found myself turning to them more and more as a kind of safety valve. For the first time in my life, in these tense, claustrophobic surroundings,
I couldn't escape into reading or study. So I fenced, quarterstaff and saber, with the other officers, worked myself to exhaustion on the exercise machines, and even kept a jump rope in my office. Most of the other officers played chess, but they could usually beat me. Whenever I won, it gave me the feeling I was being humored. Word games were difficult because my language was an archaic dialect that they had trouble manipulating, and I lacked the time and talent to master modern English. For a while I let Diana feed me mood-altering drugs, but the cumulative effect of them was frightening. I was getting addicted in a way that was at first too subtle to bother me, so I stopped short. Then I tried some systematic psychoanalysis with Lieutenant Wilbur. It was impossible. Although he knew all about my problem in an academic kind of way, we didn't speak the same cultural language. His counseling me about love and sex was like me telling a 14th-century serf how best to get along with his priest and landlord. And that, after all, was the root of my problem. I was sure I could have handled the pressures and frustrations of command, of being cooped up in a cave with these people who at times seemed scarcely less alien than the enemy, even the near certainty that it could lead only to painful death in a worthless cause. If only I could have had Mary Gay with me. And the feeling got more intense as the months crept by. He got very stern with me at this point and accused me of romanticizing my position. He knew what love was, he said. He had been in love himself, and the sexual polarity of the couple made no difference. All right, I could accept that. The idea had been a cliché in my parents' generation, though it had run into some predictable resistance in my own. But love, he said, love was a fragile blossom. Love was a delicate crystal. Love was an unstable reaction with a half-life of about 8 months. Bullshit, I said, and accused him of wearing cultural blinders. 30 centuries of pre-war society taught that love was one thing that could last to the grave and even beyond. And if he had been born instead of hatched, he would know that without being told. Whereupon he would assume a wry, tolerant expression, and reiterate that I was merely a victim of self-imposed sexual frustration and romantic delusion. In retrospect, I guess we had a good time arguing with each other. Cure me, he didn't. I did have a new friend who sat in my lap all the time. It was the cat, who had the usual talent for hiding from people who like cats and cleaving unto those who have sinus trouble or just don't like sneaky little animals. We did have something in common, though, since to my knowledge he was the only other heterosexual male mammal within any reasonable distance. He'd been castrated, of course, but that didn't make much difference under the circumstances. Chapter 6. It was exactly 400 days since the day we had begun construction. I was sitting at my desk, not checking out Hillebo's new duty roster. The cat was on my lap, purring loudly, even though I refused to pet it. Charlie was stretched out in a chair, reading something on the viewer. The phone buzzed, and it was the Commodore. They're here. What? I said they're here. A Torran ship just exited the Collapsar field. Velocity 0.80C, deceleration 30 Gs, give or take. Charlie was leaning over my desk. What? I dumped the cat. How long before you can pursue? I asked. Soon as you get off the phone. I switched off and went over to the logistic computer, which was a twin to the one on Masaryk 2 and had a direct data link to it. While I tried to get numbers out of the thing, Charlie fiddled with the visual display. The display was a hologram about a meter square by half a meter thick and was programmed to show the positions of Sada 138, our planet, and a few other chunks of rock in the system. There were green and red dots to show the positions of our vessels and the Torrens. The computer said that the minimum time it could take the Torrens to decelerate and get back to this planet would be a little over 11 days. Of course, that would be straight maximum acceleration and deceleration all the way. We could pick them off like flies on a wall. So like us, they'd mix up their direction of flight and degree of acceleration in a random way. Based on several hundred past records of enemy behavior, the computer was able to give us a probability table. The median was 28.9554 days to contact. Probability, 0.500000. Unless, of course, Antipol and her gang of merry pirates managed to make a kill. The chances of that, I had learned in the can, were slightly less than 50-50. But whether it took 28.9554 days or 2 weeks, those of us on the ground had to just sit in our hands and watch. If Antipol was successful, then we wouldn't have to fight until the regular garrison troops replaced us here and we moved on to the next collapsar.
Haven't left yet.
Charlie had the display cranked down to minimum scale. The planet was a white ball the size of a large melon, and Masaryk 2 was a green dot off to the right, some 8 melons away. You couldn't get both on the screen at the same time. While we were watching, a small green dot popped out of the ship's dot and drifted away from it. A ghostly number 2 drifted beside it, and a key projected on the display's lower left-hand corner identified it as 2, Pursuit Drone. Other numbers in the key identified the Masaryk 2, a planetary defense fighter, and 14 planetary defense drones. Those 16 ships were not yet far enough away from one another to have separate dots. The cat was rubbing against my ankle. I picked it up and stroked it. Tell Hillebo to call a general assembly. Might as well break it to everyone at once. The men and women didn't take it very well, and I couldn't blame them. We had all expected the Torrens to attack much sooner, and when they persisted in not coming, the feeling grew that Strike Force Command had made a mistake and that they'd never show up at all. I wanted the company to start weapons training in earnest. They hadn't used any high-powered weapons in almost 2 years, so I activated their laser fingers and passed out the grenade and rocket launchers. We couldn't practice inside the base for fear of damaging the external sensors and defensive laser ring, so we turned off half the circle of gigawatt lasers and went out about a click beyond the perimeter, one platoon at a time, accompanied by either me or Charlie. Rusk kept a close watch on the early warning screens. If anything approached, she would send up a flare, and the platoon would have to get back inside the ring before the unknown came over the horizon, at which time the defensive lasers would come on automatically. Besides knocking out the unknown, they would fry the platoon in less than 0.02 of a second. We couldn't spare anything from the base to use as a target, but that turned out to be no problem. The first tachyon rocket we fired scooped out a hole 20 meters long by 10 wide by 5 deep. The rubble gave us a multitude of targets, from twice man-sized on down. The soldiers were good, a lot better than they had been with the primitive weapons in the stasis field. The best laser practice turned out to be rather like skeet shooting. Pair up the people and have one stand behind the other, throwing rocks at random intervals. The one I was shooting had to gauge the rock's trajectory and zap it before it hit the ground. Their hand-eye coordination was impressive. Maybe the Eugenics Council had done something right. Shooting at rocks down to pebble size, most of them could do better than 9 out of 10. Old non-bioengineered me could hit maybe 7 out of 10, and I'd had a good deal more practice than they had.
They were equally facile at estimating trajectories with the grenade launcher, which was a more versatile weapon than it had been in the past. Instead of shooting 1 microton bombs with a standard propulsive charge, it had 4 different charges, and a choice of 1, 2, 3, or 4 microton bombs. And for really close-in fighting, where it was dangerous to use the lasers, the barrel of the launcher would unsnap, and you could load it with a magazine of shotgun rounds. Each shot would send out an expanding cloud of 1,000 tiny flechettes that were instant death out to 5 meters, and turned to harmless vapor at 6. The tachyon rocket launcher required no skill whatsoever. All you had to do was to be careful no one was standing behind you when you fired it. The backwash from the rocket was dangerous for several meters behind the launching tube. Otherwise, you just lined up your target in the crosshairs and pushed the button. You didn't have to worry about trajectory. The rocket traveled in a straight line for all practical purposes. It reached escape velocity in less than a second. It improved the troops' morale to get out and chew up the landscape with their new toys, but the landscape wasn't fighting back. No matter how physically impressive the weapons were, their effectiveness would depend on what the Taurans could throw back. A Greek phalanx must have looked pretty impressive, but it wouldn't do too well against a single man with a flamethrower. And as with any engagement, because of time dilation, there was no way to tell what sort of weaponry they would have. They might have never heard of the stasis field, or they might be able to say a magic word and make us disappear. I was out with the 4th platoon, burning rocks, when Charlie called and asked me to come back in, urgent. I left Hymoff in charge. Another one? The scale of the holograph display was such that our planet was pea-sized, about 5 centimeters from the X that marked the position of Sada 138. There were 41 red and green dots scattered around the field. The key identified number 41 as Taurin Cruiser 2. You called Antipol?
Yeah?
He anticipated the next question. It'll take almost a day for the signal to get there and back. It's never happened before. But of course Charlie knew that. Maybe this collapsar is especially important to them. Likely. So it was almost certain we'd be fighting on the ground. Even if Antipol managed to get the first cruiser, she wouldn't have a 50-50 chance on the second one. Low on drones and fighters. I wouldn't like to be Antipol now. She'll just get it earlier. I don't know. We're in pretty good shape. Save it for the troops, William. He turned down the display's scale to where it showed only 2 objects, Sada 138 and the new red dot, slowly moving. We spent the next 2 weeks watching dots blink out. And if you knew when and where to look, you could go outside and see the real thing happening, a hard, bright speck of white light that faded in about a second. In that second, a Nova bomb had put out over 1,000,000 times the power of a gigawatt laser. It made a miniature star 0.5 click in diameter and as hot as the interior of the sun. Anything it touched, it would consume. The radiation from a near miss could botch up a ship's electronics beyond repair. 2 fighters, 1 of ours and 1 of theirs, had evidently suffered that fate, silently drifting out of the system at a constant velocity, without power. We had used more powerful Nova bombs earlier in the war, but the degenerate matter used to fuel them was unstable in large quantities. The bombs had a tendency to explode while they were still inside the ship. Evidently the Taurans had the same problem, or they had copied the process from us in the first place, because they had also scaled down to Nova bombs that used less than 100 kilograms of degenerate matter, and they deployed them much the same way we did,
the warhead separating into dozens of pieces as it approached the target, only one of which was the Nova bomb. They would probably have a few bombs left over after they finished off Masaryk II and her retinue of fighters and drones. So it was likely that we were wasting time and energy in weapons practice. The thought did slip by my conscience that I could gather up 11 people and board the fighter we had hidden safe behind the stasis field. It was pre-programmed to take us back to Stargate. I even went to the extreme of making a mental list of the 11, trying to think of 11 people who meant more to me than the rest. Turned out I'd be picking 6 at random. I put the thought away, though. We did have a chance, maybe a damn good one, even against a fully armed cruiser. It wouldn't be easy to get a Nova bomb close enough to include us inside its kill radius. Besides, they'd space me for desertion. So why bother? Spirits rose when one of Antipol's drones knocked out the first Tauran cruiser. Not counting the ships left behind for planetary defense, she still had 18 drones and 2 fighters. They wheeled around to intercept the second cruiser, by then a few light hours away, still being harassed by 15 enemy drones. One of the Tauran drones got her. Her ancillary crafts continued the attack, but it was a rout. One fighter and 3 drones fled the battle at maximum acceleration and were not pursued. We watched them with morbid interest while the enemy cruiser inched back to do battle with us. The fighter was headed back for Sada 138 to escape. Nobody blamed them. In fact, we sent them a farewell good luck message. They didn't respond, naturally, being zipped up in the tanks. But it would be recorded. It took the enemy 5 days to get back to the planet and be comfortably ensconced in a stationary orbit on the other side. We settled in for the inevitable first phase of the attack, which would be aerial and totally automated, their drones against our lasers. I put a force of 50 men and women inside the stasis field, in case one of the drones got through. An empty gesture, really. The enemy could just stand by and wait for them to turn off the field, fry them the second it flickered out. Charlie had a weird idea that I almost went for. We could booby-trap the place. What do you mean? I said. This place is booby-trapped, out to 25 clicks. No, not the mines and such. I mean the base itself, here, underground. Go on. There are 2 Nova bombs in that fighter. He pointed at the stasis field through a couple of 100 meters of rock. We can roll them down here, booby-trap them, then hide everybody in the stasis field, and wait. In a way, it was tempting. It would relieve me from any responsibility for decision-making, leave everything up to chance. I don't think it would work, Charlie. He seemed hurt. Sure it would. No, look, for it to work, you have to get every single Tauran inside the kill radius before it goes off. But they wouldn't all come charging in here once they breached our defenses. Least of all, if the place seemed deserted. They'd suspect something, send in an advance party. And after the advance party set off the bombs, we'd be back where we started, yeah. Minus the base, sorry. I shrugged. It was an idea. Keep thinking, Charlie. I turned my attention back to the display where the lopsided space war was in progress. Logically enough, the enemy wanted to knock out that one fighter overhead before he started to work on us. About all we could do was watch the red dots crawl around the planet and try to score. So far, the pilot had managed to knock out all the drones. The enemy hadn't sent any fighters after him yet. I'd given the pilot control over 5 of the lasers in our defensive ring. They couldn't do much good, though. A gigawatt laser pumps out 1 billion kilowatts per second at a range of 100 meters. 1,000 clicks up, though, the beam was attenuated to 10 kilowatts. Might do some damage if it hit an optical sensor, or at least confuse things.
We could use another fighter, or six.
Use up the drones, I said. We did have a fighter, of course, and a swabby attached to us who could pilot it. It might turn out to be our only hope, if they got us cornered in the stasis field.
How far away is the other guy?
Charlie asked, meaning the fighter pilot who had turned tail. I cranked down the scale, and the green dot appeared at the right of the display.
About 6 light hours.
He had 2 drones left, 2 near to him to show as separate dots, having expended 1 in covering his getaway. He's not accelerating anymore, but he's doing 0.9G.
Couldn't do us any good if he wanted to.
He'd almost a month to slow down. At that low point, the light that stood for our own defensive fighter faded out. Shit.
Now the fun starts. Should I tell the troops to get ready? Stand by to go topside?
No. Have them suit up in case we lose air, but I expect it'll be a little while before we have a ground attack. I turned the scale up again. 4 red dots were already creeping around the globe toward us. I got suited up and came back to administration to watch the fireworks on the monitors. The lasers worked perfectly. All 4 drones converged on us simultaneously, were targeted and destroyed. All but 1 of the Nova bombs went off below our horizon. The visual horizon was about 10 kilometers away, but the lasers were mounted high and could target something at twice that distance. The bomb that detonated on our horizon had melted out a semicircular chunk that glowed brilliantly white for several minutes. An hour later, it was still glowing dull orange, and the ground temperature outside had risen to 50 degrees absolute, melting most of our snow, exposing an irregular dark gray surface. The next attack was also over in a fraction of a second, but this time there had been 8 drones, and 4 of them got within 10 clicks. Radiation from the glowing craters raised the temperature to nearly 300 degrees. That was above the melting point of water, and I was starting to get worried. The fighting suits were good to over 1,000 degrees, but the automatic lasers depended on low-temperature superconductors for their speed. I asked the computer what the laser's temperature limit was, and it printed out TR-398-734-009-265. Some aspects concerning the adaptability of cryogenic ordnance to use in relatively high-temperature environments. Which had lots of handy advice about how we could insulate the weapons if we had access to a fully equipped armorer's shop. It did note that the response time of automatic aiming devices increased as the temperature increased, and that above some critical temperature, the weapons would not aim at all. But there was no way to predict any individual weapon's behavior, other than to note that the highest critical temperature recorded was 790 degrees, and the lowest was 420 degrees. Charlie was watching the display. His voice was flat over the suit's radio.
16 this time.
Surprised? One of the few things we knew about Torran psychology was a certain compulsiveness about numbers, especially primes and powers of 2.
Let's just hope they don't have 32 left.
I queried the computer on this. All it could say was that the cruiser had thus far launched a total of 44 drones, and that some cruisers had been known to carry as many as 128. We had more than a half hour before the drones would strike. I could evacuate everybody to the stasis field, and they would be temporarily safe if one of the Nova bombs got through. Safe, but trapped. How long would it take the crater to cool down if 3 or 4, let alone 16, of the bombs made it through? You couldn't live forever in a fighting suit, even though it recycled everything with remorseless efficiency. 1 week was enough to make you thoroughly miserable. 2 weeks, suicidal. Nobody had ever gone 3 weeks under field conditions. Besides, as a defensive position, the stasis field could be a death trap. The enemy has all the options, since the dome is opaque. The only way you can find out what they're up to is to stick your head out. They didn't have to wade in with primitive weapons unless they were impatient. They could keep the dome saturated with laser fire and wait for you to turn off the generator. Meanwhile, harassing you by throwing spears, rocks, arrows into the dome, you could return fire, but it was pretty futile. Of course, if one man stayed inside the base, the others could wait out the next half hour in the stasis field. If he didn't come get them, they'd know the outside was hot. I chinned the combination that would give me a frequency available to everybody echelon 5 and above. This is Major Mandela. That still sounded like a bad joke. I outlined the situation to them and asked them to tell their troops that everyone in the company was free to move into the stasis field. I would stay behind and come retrieve them if things went well. Not out of nobility, of course. I preferred taking the chance of being vaporized in a nanosecond rather than almost certain slow death under the gray dome.
This ends Disc 7.